How y'all guys doing? Welcome to the long-awaited next installment of The Two Brandons. This is Brandon Thomas.
And this is Brandon Easton.
And we have returned with another installment for you. Before we get started, just want to do a little house cleaning. Just want to apologize for the brief kind of unexplained hiatus. I will take full responsibility for that. I've been super busy. Have gotten a little consumed in a project that I'm working on, which I'm crossing my fingers will get a green light very soon. And if that happens, once it's announced, I think everyone will understand how I kind of had to lock myself in the basement and just write furiously for months and months. So it's something that I've been working on for several months. It could be a really great opportunity for me, and trying to do the best I can with it and hope it goes through. So hopefully you guys will be hearing a little more about that in an official capacity in the next couple of months. But that's basically why I haven't been able to hook up with Easton for one of these. But, you know, we appreciate all of the love, the appreciation on the Facebook page. I know Easton and I met a couple of you guys at the recent, or kind of distant now, San Diego Comic-Con. We appreciate all the kind words and the support, and you know, we're going to get back to business. So we thought, in honor of the recent milestone achieved by Marvel Studios' latest release, Guardians of the Galaxy, crossing the $300 million mark, the highest grossing movie of the year thus far. I believe it took that title from Captain America: The Winter Soldier, which is quite an achievement for Marvel Studios. So we want to start this installment with a little talk about that movie and some things that that we think it did well, maybe some things it can improve on, and the eventual and obvious sequel. The way that I'll explain it personally is that basically, you know, there's always a moment, you know, in a movie, a book, a TV show, there's always that moment, or it's a scene or it's a line that you hear it and you're like, okay, I'm going to be into this. Like, I'm about this right now. So for me, in Guardians of the Galaxy, it was the title sequence. The title sequence in the cave with, you know, Star-Lord dancing around and kicking puddles to Come and Get Your Love. I mean, once that, basically when I saw that, I was like, okay, I'm going to like this. I'm going to like this a lot. And I did. I thought they did an incredible job overall, introducing a lot of new characters, a lot of new worlds. I really give Marvel Studios and their entire, you know, creative mechanism, give them a lot of credit for actually having the guts, having the balls to actually take a property, a little known property like Guardians of the Galaxy, which has had some critically acclaimed and popular storylines and runs over the last 5 years, but has never been what I think anyone would consider a top selling comic. And I think that there are some things that I guess you could say are a bit formulaic about Marvel Studios productions in general, but I think the one thing that they always get right, and this was spot on in Guardians, is tone. They always manage to find that sweet spot between, you know, action, you know, general menace and intensity, and having a sense of humor and a kind of levity to the characters and to the worlds that I think make them very inviting for audiences. I mean, it's not just the typical, you know, superhero trappings that everyone is wearing costumes and saying cool stuff. There's always a very nice tone that they can always find, a very good lane that they always can ride in their movies. And I think Guardians was just a very good example of basically everything that they have learned, you know, in their however many, I guess it's been almost 10 years, which is hard to imagine, but you know, in the time that they've been making these movies and designing this cool kind of interconnected universe, They've learned quite a bit, and I don't think that they would have had the courage or the infrastructure to do something like Guardians, you know, like even 5 or 7 years ago. But now, I think it worked great. Chris Pratt was I love Chris Pratt. I've liked him on Parks and Rec. I liked him in Zero Dark Thirty. And you know, he definitely had that Indiana Jones, you know, Captain Reynolds vibe going, and I just thought it was it was super cool. It was very impressive. It was surprising. It was surprising to me personally how much I enjoyed it, and I'm definitely looking forward to some more sequels and crossing fingers an eventual Guardians Avengers crossover. So. You know, we'll see if that's actually what they're leading up to. But, you know, I know you liked it quite a bit also. I think I read some of your thoughts on Facebook about it when it first came out.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I co-signed pretty much everything you said. I didn't know, to be honest, I didn't know too much about Chris Pratt because I'm not really a fan of Parks and Recreation, but I've seen this guy's face around over the years, and he seems pretty competent, and I was really impressed by his performance in the film. I mean, he really helped to carry a film as the human face in a way that you wouldn't normally expect it. You know what I mean? You don't normally get that type of hero in American cinema. I mean, it definitely reminded me of something from like a European comic book, in a sense, because Guardians of the Galaxy really pulled in from a lot of different resources. I mean, sources of, you know, storytelling. Uh-huh. Yet they managed to create something sort of original. I mean, you know, as a fan of Firefly and Serenity, you know, you definitely felt that, you know, Firefly vibe in there with the ragtag band of space thugs.
Yeah, misfits.
And bounty hunters. Yeah, misfits. And what I will say, though, is it worked because the story was generally very personal. You started off not with a space battle, but with a guy's mom dying of cancer in front of him. And then suddenly he's whisked away by a UFO. And that's not usually, most movies don't start that way, you know?
No.
And it definitely added a different level of depth, especially having the 1970s R&B and classic rock soundtrack. It found a way to endear itself to an audience that normally wouldn't go see a film like this. Because, you know, and this is a filmmaking thing I always talk about, you know, most movies have about a span of 2 to 5 minutes to get you to buy into their reality, you know, and I'll give you an example. Like if you're watching Goodfellas and Goodfellas begins a very specific way, you don't expect 10 minutes into Goodfellas for a dragon to fly out of someplace in Queens and fight the mafia guys. You know, it doesn't make sense. So, you know, an audience has a certain amount of time to adjust to the world that the filmmakers are giving to them. Right. So with Guardians of the Galaxy, they were very, very wise to ground it in like a Tarantino vibe, like using that obscure 70s classic rock soundtrack. And some of the stuff was obscure. Some of it was very, very well known. Uh-huh. But the point of using that is a great way to grab audiences emotionally. And I go back to this, and me and you have had a million discussions about the lack of emotional context in cinema these days. You know, everything is based on an emotional character connection. If you do not have that, the movie doesn't succeed. Yet, Guardians of the Galaxy managed to pull it off for at least 3 of its 4 or 5 main characters. Mm-hmm. You know, my main critique of the film, and my only real critique of it, is the villains kind of sucked.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Ronan was just a snarling guy talking about religious purity and cleansing. And, you know, Thanos showed up for a couple of minutes, which I was really happy to see him. And then you had, what was her name? Nebula? Who was the
Nebula.
Yeah, Nebula, who in the comics is pretty well developed, but in the movie, she's just kind of like
the angry sister.
Yeah, the angry sister who's mad and jealous and the Cinderella complex all over again. Same old shit. So that was the thing that bothered me the most. I felt that the villains were kind of boring. Mm-hmm. I would have liked to have seen the Nova Corps be the Nova Corps instead of being, I don't know, the Battlestar Galactica crew.
Yeah, they're kind of like, it seems like they're just kind of space cops.
Yeah, and I wanted to see them use their helmets as basically the power rings, you know, so to speak. But, you know, I understand what Marvel had to do. They really had a lot to set up, so you wouldn't see the Nova Corps in their full glory. But those are two minor gripes. You know, the shitty villains, it wasn't enough for me to totally disconnect. And Rocket Raccoon and Groot being the most popular characters to come out of that, you know, was shocking to me, because these are two characters that, I'll say this, I did not give a flying a crap about. I don't care about Groot. I mean, I remember Rocket Raccoon from back in the day, back in the 80s, and I was like, I don't care about this character at all, you know? And I didn't even know what Groot was. I mean, I would see pictures, I'm like, what is, you know, because I haven't been as engaged with current Marvel continuity, particularly the current Marvel cosmic continuity. Okay. So I honestly had no idea what Groot was. I just thought, oh, who is this guy? But, you know, another thing was that the filmmakers, the writers, and the director managed to make these characters very real. And these are characters that normally would turn off most audiences. So props go to them for that. Also, I got to give props to Dave Bautista, who played Drax, who brought so much energy and so much power to a role that is incredibly hard to pull off. He pulled it off. He was basically an autistic warrior, badass, who didn't get subtleties, didn't get metaphors, didn't get tone. He was almost autistic in a way, you know? Mm-hmm. And yet, Dave Bautista's charisma shined through all that makeup. And out of all the wrestlers I thought would make a transition from the WWE to Hollywood, Dave Bautista was low on my list of people who I thought could pull it off. And yet, he was very endearing. So once again, when you get to the characters and you get to an emotional connection, Guardians of the Galaxy pulled it off in ways that most summer movies this last summer did not do at all. Like, there were so many movies that came out this summer that had no emotional investment. Yet, I actually cared about these guys. And also, another factor is, and a lot of people still don't get this, people do like space movies. Yes. You got to make more of them. If you make more space movies, guess what? People will go see them.
Yeah. I know that this was, this was an unknown quantity to a lot of people, but it was surprising to me how little faith some people on the outside had in the potential for the film. I mean, I don't think that many people thought that it would be the highest grossing, movie of the year, but
absolutely
I was
not.
Pretty sure that Marvel, wasn't gonna like lose their house over it. You know, I was pretty sure based on their track record that it was gonna be a reasonable success, especially if it was good. And, it's just one of those things where people have a habit of really overcomplicating the essential issue. It's like, if the shit is good, if it's fun, people will go see it. And people will go see it over and over again, and they will tell other people to go see it. It's a really simple concept that, everyone tries to kind of bury in a bunch of, BS, and like, this is why this worked. This is why this fit. It's like, it's pretty simple. I mean, the shit was good. The characters were cool. The visuals were dope. You know, there was more than enough emotional kind of resonance to kind of hang on to at different right. points in the film, and it left you wanting more, and that's basically how it's done. One thing I will say about the weakness of the villains in the film, which is actually a pretty common criticism of the Marvel movies in general, if you notice, basically the further removed from the main hero that the villain is, the less engaging it tends to be. You know, like, if you think about the Marvel movies and you think about, their most successful villains, you have Loki. I think Bucky as the Winter Soldier worked extremely well. You know, the closer that the villain can get to the actual hero, that seems to be a villain that they have a slightly easier time of kind of making the audience engaged in. You know, when it becomes kind of just like this faceless, growling threat with some big cool weapon or some
right,
big
exactly.
evil, some big evil thing they're trying to do, I think it's a little harder to plug people in. And I think that, they did a lot of setup in regards to, who Star-Lord's father is and what are going to be the larger implications of that. So I'm pretty sure that going forward, especially in the next movie, I think that you know, I think that the villain in that movie will probably be a little more engaging and stick with people a little harder than maybe Ronan did. And especially once Thanos gets more and more integrated into the main narrative, I think that'll also be something that they can definitely improve on. I mean, I think there's always room for improvement. And, you know, the first movie it's usually not the best one, you know, in certain cases. I guess in Iron Man's case, the first movie was probably the best. But, yes, you know, absolutely. I'm really looking forward to what they bring in the sequel, especially now that this movie has made money and it's been a big success. And I think that that will allow them to really kind of cut loose.
Yes.
You know, and not have to kind of hold our hands while they're kind of walking us through this new world and these new characters. So I thought it was a great introduction. And I think it shows that the way that Marvel is kind of casting and putting these movies together while they can't get too many originality points overall, I think that they really understand the total package. They really understand that if we can get, you know, 5, 6, 7 little things to work, we can put this all together. And like you said, we can convince people to buy in. You know, once I got into that cave and, you know, the titles were rolling, I was like, I'm into this.
Right.
This is, you know, this is cool. This is dope. I'm already, you know, kind of like a geek for cool title sequences anyway. So it's just something that really kind of spoke to me personally. And I knew I was going to love the movie from that moment on. And, you know, and I was right. And I can't wait to see what else they do with it. So,
I wanted to kind of follow up on a point that you raised. If you look at, and I consider Captain America: The Winter Soldier the best Marvel movie made yet, mm-hmm. you know, overall. They did a really good job of structuring the villain's motivation and what everybody actually wants. You know, because the question is, what do you want and what do you need? Good scripts usually ask that question of all the characters. Mm-hmm. What do you want and then what do you need? Those are usually not the same things. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So with that being said, you know, The Winter Soldier, because Marvel, in my opinion, the Marvel formula and all their movies basically follow the exact same formula, but it works extremely well, okay? Mm-hmm. But that has, what you said about that being a criticism, it is a huge criticism because outside of Loki, most Marvel villains, particularly the Marvel Studios villains, they're not exactly engaging and they're not really magnetic.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of there to move the characters from point A to point B. Right. And we can even go back as far as Iron Man 1, mm-hmm. where, you know, Obadiah Stane, I mean, he was okay. I mean, you know, you got Jeff Bridges, for God's sake, but,
right.
you know, the guy can act his way, you know, he can do anything he wants as an actor. He's that good.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't feel like he was really a menace or a true threat. It was more of like a corporate Armor Wars kind of thing from back in
right.
the day that you can definitely play it out differently on a comic book page, but to bring Armor Wars to a movie when you're just starting out, it didn't exactly engage me as a villain. Mm-hmm. I was happy to see Iron Man done well, you know, and I would say the best Marvel villain overall, other than in the Winter Soldier, was Deacon Frost back in the first Blade movie.
Yeah.
Because he had magnetism, he had a motivation, he was engaging.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I think they're really going to have to work on in the future. And it looks like they have worked on it. Obviously, judging by Captain America 2, you know, they've gotten the message that a villain has to be as magnetic as the hero.
Yeah.
You know, and it worked extremely well.
I'm really anxious to see how they work Ultron in Avengers
yeah.
2.
That's going to be interesting because Ultron doesn't have a face, as
right.
You know, and James Spader can act. But the question is, are they going to play it out like Jarvis, like the Jarvis voice where he has a personality, or is Ultron going to be emotionless?
Mm-hmm.
And in my mind, and I've never, I mean, I know that they've animated Ultron in some of the Marvel, you know, cartoon series lately.
Mm-hmm.
But in my mind, Ultron sounds like a Cylon, like the old Battlestar Galactica Cylons.
Uh-huh.
That's in my mind. Obviously, you know, Marvel writers, everybody has their own voice in their head. But I'm wondering how they're going to pull off Ultron, because he's a robot or android or whatever, and make him engaging and magnetic as a villain. Because there's going to have to be some kind of device used, some storytelling device where you actually feel for Ultron, or in some way understand what he wants. You know, and the best example of that would be, you know, 2001 A Space Odyssey. There's no real villain in that movie other than Hal. And Hal, for those who haven't seen it, Hal is the computer that controls the exploratory human vessel in 2001 A Space Odyssey, which was directed by Stanley Kubrick, and it was released in 1969. The thing about 2001 A Space Odyssey is that it is so realistic. Even today, if you watch the science of it, a good chunk of it feels like this is what it's going to be like for humans to go to Jupiter or go to Mars. And the computer, Hal, malfunctioned at some point during the trip and started to kill off the astronauts. And there was a very interesting scene in the film where they have to go into his memory core and kill him, basically disconnect his chips. And as he, quote unquote, dies, he just starts singing songs and he sounds like a child. And it's done in such a way that you almost feel bad that they're killing off this computer who already killed some humans, you know? But you're also talking about master filmmaker Stanley Kubrick, and you're talking about a script based on master writer Arthur C. Clarke, you know? So we're talking about a level of storytelling and filmmaking that, quite frankly, won't be replicated in our lifetime. So with that being said, you know, it's going to be very, I mean, when I look at cinema, I always compare cinema to all of cinema. I don't just look at it as the last 10 years. I look at the whole spectrum of what you can do with the art of cinema. And the Marvel movies are very good products. The Winter Soldier was the first one that felt like an actual movie. You know, like a lot of the other, I mean, even Avengers was great, but it felt like we were being sold like toys in a way. Whereas the Winter Soldier had a great story that wasn't, it didn't feel like I was buying, he was trying to sell me toys and action figures. You know what I mean? Even Guardians of the Galaxy at times felt like it was trying to sell me toys and action figures.
Definitely.
You know,
it felt like, this is the Halloween costume you're going
exactly. So, in a way, I'm very much looking forward to the Age of Ultron movie, whatever they're going to call it. I'm really looking forward to it. But at the same time, you know, I am a little concerned about how Josh Whedon is going to pull this off, because when I think back on all of Josh Whedon's villains, particularly from Buffy and Angel, they were humans or they were demons that had very human vices and very human failings. Right. And I wonder how that's going to translate into Ultron.
Buffy is basically a metaphor for growing up. You know, essentially, you know, kind of like these childhood experiences that have these awful demon faces to them.
Right.
But,
exactly.
The emotion is all the same. But I mean, I'm really looking forward to it. I'm really excited about what they accomplished. And, you know, we'll use this to kind of move into the next thing we're going to talk about. I think that tone is so important, and having a sense of humor about something that's occurring in the movie, even if it's terrible, is also important. And that leads us into our next discussion point, which is Batman v Superman, whatever that is supposed to imply.
Oh, God almighty.
And the burgeoning, you know, DC movie universe that is in the process of being created right now. And when we talk about that more,
did you see the teaser from Comic-Con by any chance?
Okay. I did.
All right.
I saw it. It was fun and very, very quick. And, I don't know. I liked it. I don't know if I was as crazy about it as everyone else. I mean, personally, you know, I was trying to find the Avengers footage, you know, lot harder than I was trying to find this little 5-second clip.
I could not find the Avengers footage anywhere.
No.
I looked.
No, it has not leaked yet. The thing that has leaked, if you look for it, someone the audio leaked, right? So the audio of the actual clip leaked, and then someone basically drew corresponding storyboards.
Did
they? And then paired them with the audio to basically kind of give people a walkthrough of, you know, the actual images in the trailer. It's actually really cool, and I just saw it, and I was like, oh, man, nerds, boy. So, and then I watched it three times, so.
Exactly.
When I say that, I include myself in with, you know, with that, but something we definitely want to talk about, you know, talking about tone in the Marvel Studios movies. Okay. There was a kind of a rumored report that came out recently that basically Warner Brothers has instituted like a no jokes. I'm calling the no smiles policy in right. Their superhero universe, which should be an interesting experiment. And, you know, and not to say, clearly you can't believe every single thing that you read on the internet, but I thought it was telling when they made the official announcement about the Shazam movie, you know, that The Rock is going to be a part of, that right. they specifically mentioned that, yeah, you know, this is going to come out from New Line, and it's going to be completely separate from the rest of the DC movieverse, and it's going to have a sense of humor, and it's going to be fun. So I thought it was very, to me, it sounded almost like a bit of a confirmation that something like that is really going on. And I'm sure it's not, you know, a hard and fast rule, you know, that there will be no jokes in any of these movies. But I think it's just a very interesting, kind of an interesting perspective to take. I mean, I know that they do want to distinguish themselves from what Marvel is doing, so it's not just the DC version of the, you know, the Marvel movieverse, but it's funny that when they say that, they're like, yeah, it's like the Dark Knight trilogy. And it's like, actually, the Dark Knight trilogy has plenty of jokes in it if you actually watch it and pay attention to it and not just be like, oh, yeah, it's happening at night, so nothing is funny. I mean, there are a lot of, you know, jokes and moments of levity between, you know, Bruce and Alfred and Bruce and Selina. So, you know, I think this idea is actually accurate, if this is something that has actually been discussed even in a semi-serious way, you know, I think it's I think it'll be an interesting thing to see play out. And I think that using the Dark Knight trilogy as kind of the reason why they want to take this track is a bit misguiding, and it's like a deliberate misreading of their own movies and what people actually like about them.
Well, you know what this is really a result of, and this is where I get into a lot of fights online. This is a result of the bat fetishism that's popped up in the last 25 years. And let me break this down, because you know a lot about comic books, even you know more about comic book like minutia than I do. And you can tell me all kind of stuff. But from what I understand, and this is from my own life, I don't remember Batman being as popular in the way that he's popular now back in the early 80s, because the pre-crisis Batman stories, other than the Denny O'Neil stuff, I don't think was all that engaging. And it seems like right when Crisis ended and they brought Frank Miller in to do Year One, then, of course, a couple of years later, Dark Knight Returns dropped. But there was this period where I still don't remember this bat fanaticism and fetishism that's going on now. And I think a lot of it is directly a result of the Dark Knight Returns graphic novel, you know, because it seems like there's a generation of people who are basically our age who take Batman very seriously, more seriously than I've ever seen any generation take Batman at all. Maybe the animated series has something to do with it too.
Which was excellent.
Well, that's one of the greatest animated shows, if not the greatest animated series of all time, action-wise. But when I think about it, I'm just saying that people take Batman to this level that doesn't make any sense. And it feels like that Elseworld story, and let me, you know, make it very clear to everyone who's listening who knows what I'm talking about, which they probably do. The Dark Knight Returns is an alternate universe That is not the mainstream DC universe. The events in that story are not going to happen in the mainstream universe because we're kind of close to that time period that was, you know, established in the Dark Knight Returns comic. So the idea of an armored Batman, even with a kryptonite, a synthetic kryptonite arrow fired by a one-armed Oliver Queen, I still do not believe by any stretch of the imagination that Batman would be able to defeat Superman in a fight. And it drives me up the wall that all these fans, just because of that one scene, that great scene when he has a hand at his throat that people talk about forever. Yeah, it's great, right? But if we're dealing with the DC Cinematic Universe versions of these characters, that means we have the Man of Steel version of Superman, the one who clearly is a complete asshole, who does not care about hurting. You know, I've watched Man of Steel on Blu-ray because I like the supplemental stuff when they talk about developing Superman. And when I watch the final battle, there's a moment when Zod kicks an oil tanker, a LexCorp oil tanker, at Superman. And what does he do? He doesn't stop it from hitting the building. He just dodges it, turns around and watches it hit the building and blow up the entire building.
Right.
And I thought to myself, there's no goddamn way on earth a guy like that is going to be beaten by a human being. And that's what I'm talking about. Like, we can have this argument about the comic book versions, but the Man of Steel version, this asshole version of Superman, who kills people, who blows up entire cities, who throws trucks and tanks, knocks over buildings just to make a point. You know, this guy is not going to be easily beaten by a human being with a lot of money. You know, so I'm really interested how they're going to pull this off. Unless they have Bruce Wayne discover kryptonite, you know, which is probably what's going to happen, I'm guessing. Or Lex Luthor, whatever they're going to do with it. Yeah. I just feel that the idea of Batman versus Superman is so bizarre. Because the Superman they've established, that Zack Snyder has established, this guy is almost a villain, you know? And it's like, yeah, I mean, Batman could barely get past Bane. And Bane is just a little bit stronger than him. I mean, Bane basically could have killed him. So we're talking about a dude who can throw people into space, who can walk through flames, who can walk through ice, who can survive in the vacuum of space indefinitely. You know, we're talking about a guy like this who went underneath a machine, who flew into a graviton beam to disable a machine. He's supposed to be beaten by a human being in battle armor. That doesn't make any sense to me. And this is what drives me crazy with bat fetishists, because they're like, oh, he can beat anybody. I'm like, look, just because Dwayne McDuffie and just because Grant Morrison came up with some semi-plausible explanation of how Batman could possibly defeat the Justice League, when in truth, Wonder Woman with a solid punch will take his head off his neck. You know, I mean, it doesn't make any sense. And this bat fetishism really has... I know that Batman comics sell extremely well, and I think that's the reason why he's been fetishized in such a way. And Scott Snyder does a great job on the Batman comics. But even in the New 52, Superman's kind of a dick. and he's not afraid to use his powers. Like, the John Byrne Man of Steel post-crisis Superman that I adore, that's not this guy. This is not the Superman that wouldn't hurt people. This guy doesn't really care. You know, and I can see, I mean, even in that horrible animated New 52 Justice League reboot animation thing, like, even Batman and Green Lantern were like, you know, we got to be real careful with this dude because he actually doesn't care about hurting things. You know, so I'm just wondering how they're going to make this a legitimate fight. And I mean, I'm just trying to, I just can't imagine this visually, you know?
Okay, well, here we go. Anytime, and people don't know this, of course, because anytime this comes up, I'm like, oh, God, here's Easton again with this Superman Batman thing. Why are we still talking about it?
Because people keep bringing it up. Okay. I ain't the only one that brings this up.
So let's talk about it. First of all, about Man of Steel. You know why I like Man of Steel? Because everybody hates it.
Right.
I find that, you know, I kind of watched the movie the first time and I'm like, oh, you know, this is all right. You know, I think I can kind of see like what they're building, because, you know, I think that what they're building is basically a version of Superman who learns not to be an asshole, like a version of Superman that starts out being an asshole and being like, you know, I can kill this guy if he's like a danger to me and other people, you know, that's okay, whatever. You know, I think that they want to start him at that point and then move him a little closer to, you know, the Superman as he has traditionally been depicted. But the more I hear people like bitch and moan and complain about it, I kind of hope that, you know what, maybe they'll just leave him just an asshole. Maybe, you know, it's kind of like, and, you know, and I know, and I'm going to say something and hopefully it doesn't derail us completely,
but
it's kind of how I feel about Star Trek fans that are just like, Star Trek Into Darkness is the worst Star Trek movie ever made. And I'm like, I just like fly off into a rage.
Right,
like,
right.
Even as someone that, you know, only saw like the Next Generation movies, who just recently saw a couple of the original movies, it's just like, that's ridiculous. That's nonsense. And you know what? Maybe Star Trek fans don't deserve any more movies. Maybe you should just keep watching these reruns and keep reading these books that have the real Star Trek in them, and
right,
then that's
right.
the end. So that's kind of how I feel about, you know, kind of these Superman fanboys that like grew up with a certain, you know, version of Superman when they were 10, and they can't let go of it. I mean, you just have to. There's something that as a consumer of, you know, of pop culture, as someone who like loves comics and sci-fi and all of this stuff, you just have to acknowledge that this shit is not going to stay the same.
No,
and
that's true.
The things that resonated with you as a 10-year-old are not going to resonate with a 10-year-old, you know, right now. It's just not. You know, the world is different. The world is constantly changing, and our entertainment changes with it. You know, the type of stories that everybody is telling. I mean, if you notice now, in every movie is all about the evil corporation. There's always some evil corporation that's trying to dominate you or is in charge of this conspiracy to ruin your lives. And, you know, and that's because that's how people feel now.
Yep.
You know, they feel like, you know, like we're under siege by these corporations and these conglomerates and these special interests and blah, blah, blah. The point is that thinking that Man of Steel was going to be the same, you know, old version of Superman that we keep seeing, that people keep telling that people keep saying they don't want, to think that that would be the Superman that they would keep giving us,
it's
lunacy. I mean,
well, they already tried to give us that Superman.
Exactly. There's a reason why they stopped making Superman movies. There's a reason why everybody was complaining about Superman Returns, which, I mean, I didn't think was that terrible. I was a little aggravated that he didn't get to actually punch anything in the movie, which I think Man of Steel took to like the 1,000th power, and it made him like, well, we're going to go from a guy that doesn't punch anything to a guy that punches everything and doesn't stop. So, you know, I think that both of those kind of interpretations of Superman are kind of, you know, on two extremes, but just the kind of just full-throated resistance that a lot of people have had to accepting Man of Steel as a slightly different version and interpretation of Superman. It's like you have to consider the modern audience. The modern audience doesn't want to see those Richard Donner Superman movies anymore. No matter how much you loved them when you were 6, and no matter how much they meant to you personally, I mean, seriously, I'll tell this story. I've been keeping this a secret. But I mean, seriously, I liked the first couple of Superman movies okay, and I tried to watch them recently with my wife, who had never seen them before. And you know what the word that I, you know, the one feeling that I felt while watching those movies? Embarrassment.
Wow.
I was like, this is like the most dated, it's like basically nostalgia kills. It kills. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes you just have to be able to let go of a feeling that you had about something a long time ago and let someone else come into it in a slightly different way. I mean, I just don't, personally, I do not feel that those movies hold up very well at all. I mean, I know that that's kind of just, you know, that's kind of the price of doing business. But even story-wise, I just, like, I don't want to see bumbling Clark Kent anymore. You know, basically, like, All-Star Superman for me was kind of like closed the chapter on, like, bumbling, stumbling Clark Kent.
Right.
And it was kind of like, you know, writer Grant Morrison came up with what I thought was a very kind of interesting perspective, where while, you know, Clark is kind of bumbling around and tripping over his own feet, he's actually, like, helping people, you know, from things and threats that they're not even aware of. And kind of without that element, to me, it just feels like, you know, like Clark Kent is kind of just like a bumbling fool, and I don't like it. I mean, I don't like Lex Luthor's ridiculous subterranean lair. I mean, I'm just watching this movie and I'm just like, wow.
But you have to understand something about that. If you think that was bad, you should have saw what Richard Donner had to do to get it away from where they were going.
Yeah.
You know, if you ever look up the story behind it, the original story was stupid. In defense of the Richard Donner Superman, I will say this. All the Smallville stuff was extremely well done.
Particularly
the scene up until he leaves. Mm-hmm. It is very Norman Rockwell-esque, and it's extremely beautiful. Now, when he leaves and my problem with Superman 1 is just that they knew in 1978 they had to figure out a way to get people into that theater. And so the comedy aspect of it, which is very interesting, is what really probably kept people rooted to it, because this is the 70s, mm-hmm. and this is a time when filmmaking got dark as shit.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to look at it in the context in which it was created. Because if you look at a lot of older stuff now with modern eyes, everything is going to look really bad, particularly special effects-wise. You know, because they were doing rear projection for the flight sequences, and it was deeply problematic. Now, for me personally, I don't have a problem with differing interpretations, because, like I said, the John Byrne version of Superman was not the Superman I actually remember. Because the Superman I grew up with actually was the Super Friends version, you know, from the 70s, who could do just about anything. The pre-crisis Superman, who could, like, kick a planet out of... I mean, it was stupid. Because how can you physically you can't kick a planet. But anyway, my issue really, and this is my whole point, is that I just don't think this modern version could be beaten by a human being in battle armor.
Right.
Like, that's all I'm saying. It's like, I don't care that they made him, like, a psychopath. I'm like, whatever. You know, he's an alien. Let him rip the earth. Because it's not like I'm not going to see Batman and Superman. And it's not like I'm not going to see Man of Steel 2 or 3 or whatever they're going to call it.
Right.
It's not like I'm not going to see him.
Right.
It's just that I think that it was jarring. Because I think a lot of this started when Mark Waid said, this is not Superman. Mm-hmm. And a lot of fanboys jumped on that. Because I remember the moment when I read that, and I was like, well, you know, I respect Mark Waid. He's written some kick-ass Superman stories.
Yes, he has.
So he should know.
Right.
You know, I mean, and I think a lot of the argument really was that Superman doesn't kill. I think it came down to that, and then we go back and forth about the Phantom Zone criminals and blah, blah, blah.
And punching and blah, blah,
right,
blah.
Exactly. So, you know, the way I look at it is that if they want to change Superman to being a little tougher, I have no problem with that at all. I'm just wondering how, given what they've established with his power levels in Man of Steel, in the first Man of Steel film, it's like, how are you either have to find a way to depower him or be extremely unrealistic in a way that Batman, you know, a human, can affect him without kryptonite.
Right.
That's really what I'm not getting. I'm like, how are they going to pull this off without kryptonite? You're going to have to bring kryptonite into it, but then that's kind of a cheat, because obviously kryptonite will weaken him.
Right.
Clearly. So for me, I'm just wondering how Ben Affleck in bat armor is going to stop, you know, this version of Superman, who's like pretty much unstoppable. I mean, he was throwing this, like, in the end of Man of Steel, he threw a satellite at an army general and was like, dude, you know, stop following me. You know, and I'm just like, what the hell? I'm like, what? He did what?
And see, you know, and like, I love stuff like that. And like I said,
it's fine. But it's like, this guy is not going to be somebody who's going to take lightly that a human in armor is trying to take him down.
Right.
You know, this is going to be a problem. So if this guy can, like, literally, I mean, you saw what he did to Zod. He's like punching him through buildings that went blocks and, you know, turning, like, flipping buildings upside down on top of each other, fighting into space and then fighting back to Earth, you know, burning up in orbit and still, you know, fight. I mean, it's like, how are you going to stop this guy? You know, I mean, really, I mean, really think about this now. It's like, this is not that, you know, the weaker Lois and Clark, you know, version. What's that dude's name? Dean Cain. Yeah. This is not the Dean Cain Superman. This is Henry Cavill, who played a Greek god in the movie before he played Superman, you know, in Immortals. So this dude is not somebody that's going to be like, oh yeah, I'm just going to take this lightly. You know, this guy's going to kill people. He's going to hurt Bruce Wayne a lot. You know, it's like he's gonna hurt this guy, and I'm waiting for that. But I know what's gonna happen. We're gonna see the movie, and half the 70% of the fans in the audience are gonna be cheering for Batman. So if they set up Superman as the villain, which I feel is kind of where they're gonna go with it, you know, you're gonna see people cheering and booing depending on who, you know, gets hit hardest and all this. I mean, it's gonna be great. I'm just waiting for it. You know, I just want to see how this is gonna work. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the question. The whole Batman Superman question is just, you know, I think it's just funny and silly in certain ways, just because, you know, Superman is never going to get into a fist fight with Batman, like a straight up fight, just like he's not going to fight Lex Luthor. I mean, if he was willing to fight normal human beings, then, you know, Lex Luthor would be dead. The Toy Man would be, you know, all of these, you know, all of these dudes that have no powers and no cybernetic enhancements would be dead. So, I mean, the whole kind of, like, comic version of, you know, who wins, Batman, Superman, I mean, technically, yes, of course, Superman has greater powers, and, you know, but Superman is never just going to get into a fist fight with Batman.
Well, the Man of Steel version might.
But, see, that's the thing, though, right? You know, is the Man of Steel version... And like I said, I believe that they're probably going to basically move him further and further away from the Man of Steel and closer to a Superman that's a little, you know, that's a little
kinder, a little and
closer to everyone's favorite version of Superman. So, you know, I think this will be part of that character's development. The Man of Steel version of Superman, not just putting his fists through Bruce and his stupid armor, I believe is going to be part of his development and part of, you know, spending more time on Earth and not, you know, hiding somewhere on a boat with a cool beard. So, you know, I mean, I know that it's something that, you know, fanboys and us nerds like to, you know, talk about, and it's very, the outcome of it is very important. But I mean, the essential question really makes no sense at all, because I mean, it would be like, I mean, it's like anything, you know, you can't say who would win in a fight between, you know, like Superman and like Jimmy Olsen, or like what if Superman fought the Joker? Like, I mean, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, like Superman will never just put his hand through Bruce's chest, you know, no matter how.
And
that's a version of the character. You know, if Bruce Wayne had Superman's powers, he would be an asshole. You know that because of, you know, how he is. Bruce Wayne Bruce Wayne is an asshole. I mean, I know that he has all the, you know, the cool gadgets and stuff, but I mean, he just is. I mean, he manipulates everyone. Everyone in his life, you know, he manipulates to get stuff out of them and get them to do the things that he needs them to do. I mean, he's emotionally closed off. I mean, this is not a, you know, he's, Batman's cool, but Batman's also an asshole. And if he had Superman's powers, Batman would basically take over the world, which is why Batman doesn't have Superman's powers. You know, without Superman's, you know, kind of upbringing and kind of this thing that his parents have instilled in him, he would be Batman. He would just be basically flying around and throwing people off buildings. And people forget that there are versions of Superman that did that. you know, that threw like slumlords off the roof of their buildings. And,
this
you know,
is true. So yeah, the 1930s and 40s version.
Yeah, so I mean,
he would protect union guys. He'd be fighting mobsters.
I mean, if you go back far enough, you can find pretty much any version of Superman that you like personally, identify it as your version of Superman, and then try to disavow all the other versions of Superman that are just as equally valid. I mean, it's a continuum, and I just based on how Man of Steel went, I mean, I don't think that the goal of Batman versus Superman is gonna make him more asshole, because I mean, how is Lex Luthor gonna be a threat to him if he's a complete asshole, if he'll just, you know, like pull the top off of Lex's building and throw it into space because Lex said something to him that he didn't like? I mean, you know, people just need to think about stuff, man. It's like, it's not as, you know, it's not as dire, and it's not as set in stone as, you know, as people want to make things. And I know that, like you said, for a lot of people, it's that, you know, Superman doesn't kill. Well, you know what? Superman has killed before in certain instances. And to me, personally, and I've said this before, so I'll keep it short. To me, the problem wasn't that Superman killed Zod. I just thought that they didn't earn the moment when he killed Zod.
Right.
I think the fact that they intentionally went for this very kind of bloodless, like PG-13 blockbuster, like buildings are falling, but we don't really see the people that the buildings are falling on, you know, then maybe no one actually died. Right? Maybe the city was evacuated because we didn't see it. And then you try to make the emotional crux of the movie that Zod is going to like fry these people with heat vision and Superman can't stop him. You know, I just think that there were, you know, there were a few ways that they could have earned that moment. And not to say that that wouldn't have been enough for people. You know, people that didn't like that aspect of it just weren't gonna like it, but I think it just would have made for, you know, a slightly better movie and a kind of more satisfying kind of climax to the whole thing. But like you said, this version of Superman is gonna be really interesting, you know, how Batman can even keep up with him, because it's especially they've already said that Bruce Wayne is going to be old and tired.
Exactly.
And ready to retire. So this whole, like, you know, it'll be interesting to see exactly how they pull it off. And they'll probably use kryptonite, because that's the easiest thing to, you know, to do to depower him to some kind of manageable level. And like you said, all these people that are complaining about it, all these people that are complaining about Ben Affleck as Batman, and, you know, there are guns on the Batmobile. It's like, newsflash, look at the Batmobiles from the last several movies. There are guns on everything. There are guns on the cars. He had guns on his bike. He had guns on his plane. I mean, every single thing that Bruce Wayne has put together, or I'm sorry, Lucius Fox has put together for him, was developed for the military. So it has military grade weaponry on it. And this whole, like, it was just so funny to me. It's like, does being a nerd mean that you have no memory, that you like intentionally like black out things that don't feed into your own personal argument? You know, I saw all of these like, oh my God, why does the new Batmobile have guns on it? It's like,
dude, really? Like, dude, people go too far.
There have been guns
stuff,
on,
man,
like the Batmobile and the Batwing since like Burton. Tim Burton had guns on the Batwing. I remember the scene. I mean, they referenced it in The Dark Knight, the scene where Joker stands in the middle of the street and basically dares Batman to shoot him, and he can't because I can't kill people. I mean, this whole notion that, like, oh my God, and I think at this point, you know, people just want to, you know, they just want to kind of take shots at Zack Snyder and, you know, and whatever. I mean, to me, criticize the thing that actually, to me, I'm more annoyed that DC is basically trying to jump to the front of the line and do Justice League without doing any of the work to get them to Justice League. Yes. Like, that's more kind of, you know, personally annoying to me. Not the fact that there are guns on this Batmobile, which there have been guns on the Batmobile for years now, and not that Ben Affleck is playing Batman either. I mean, I just, at the end of the day, everybody's going to go see it because nobody wants to be the person that hasn't seen it.
Exactly. And they'll complain before, they'll complain during, and they'll complain after.
Right. Right. And basically, they just want your money. You know, they're not really interested in all of this kind of, kind of this pregame commentary that admittedly a lot of us participate in. So, I mean, as with anything, I hope it's good. I wish them the best. I'll be there to see it opening weekend, and I'll be interested, you know, kind of how they settle some of these questions and kind of problems that it seems like they're going to have, you know. And I think the only way narratively that they can really solve that problem is to have the movie be about Superman kind of proving to the world that he's not a complete asshole and that he's not completely untrustworthy and that he's not just going to break everything, you know, as his number one solution to solve every problem. I mean, I think if that was going to be the case, the villain in this movie wouldn't be Lex Luthor. You know, I think there would be another Zod level adversary for him. And there probably will be kind of like a kind of sub villain just so Superman will have something cool to punch, you know, that's not Batman in his stupid suit. But, you know, I just think that people just kind of like need to be a little more patient and, you know, just kind of see what happens, see how it evolves, and just let the stuff be what it is. You know, Man of Steel Superman is different from pre-crisis Superman, which is different from post-crisis, which is different from the animated series version, which is
a whole different Superman.
Exactly, which is different from the version of the 30s, which is different from the version in Dark Knight Returns and all the other Elseworld stories that there have been of, you know, what happened if Superman's an asshole or, you know, he's found by Russians or, all of this stuff. And I think that just like Batman, the character is flexible. And I think that there is a kind of a core, you know, element of Superman. And in Man of Steel, the core element of Superman was that he came from another planet. He's the last survivor of a dead world. And I think that to a lot of people, that wasn't the core of that wasn't the essence of Superman. To a lot of people, the essence of Superman is his upbringing, you know, with like these kindly, good-hearted white people living on a farm, you know, that taught him, you know, to never hurt anybody and never make a mistake. And, you know, which, again, that works for certain things, but I can see, I know why they chose not to go that route. Because they didn't want people rolling their eyes in the movie. They didn't want people thinking like, oh, here we go again. It's like, oh, yeah, you know, the kindly parents, you know, taught us right from wrong. And now we're ready to go out and face the world. You know, that's not, to be honest, that's not the experience of young people nowadays. I mean, what young person actually believes that their parents have prepared them for everything they'll ever see in life at the age of 22? I mean, it's just not that, you know, there's a lot of kind of, you know, fumbling through life. And I thought that that's something that they wanted to bring to that character. And I think showing that character go through something like that is not, you know, a cardinal sin. It's not the worst thing that's ever happened, and it doesn't break Superman. And I'm telling you, they can't make him, the goal can't be to just like, let's make him more of an asshole than he was in the first movie.
Right.
You know, I believe wholeheartedly that the path for these movies is basically teaching him not to be an asshole, teaching him not to like use his powers in destructive ways, you know, to get the result that he wants. I basically think that, you know, we're going to watch the Man of Steel become Superman ultimately.
Right, right.
And I think, you know, I
but you know, the fan base has to complain about something,
I guess.
You know, honestly, like, everybody has an opinion on, you know, their version of something and so forth and so on. But some people go too far. And that's really where I come in at, where I say, you know, you just got to let it go. I mean, there's a lot of really important things happening in the world. And, you know, what Marvel and DC does with characters you don't own, you know, there's only so far, you can't really do anything about that after a while.
Right.
You know what I mean? You just got to kind of let it go and be like, okay, well, this is what it is, and that's that. You know, let's move on. Let's pay attention to, you know, police brutality or wars or economy or finding a job or educating our children.
Right.
You know, ultimately, you know, there are things that are important, and, you know, I'm still going to support the things I'm going to support, but, you know, I think sometimes we don't want to, you know, and this goes back to the prolonged adolescence thing I always talk about, where, you know, you say, you know, nostalgia is a problem, and nostalgia is, because some people don't know how to let it go, you know, and I had to let go Transformers a long time ago, you know, because I'm not Michael Bay, and if they ever pay me to tell the Transformers story I want to tell, then I'll do it, but I'm not going to expect Michael Bay to tell the story I want to see.
Right.
You know, and I you know, and it's just, instead of complaining about it, I just don't, I won't go see these movies anymore.
Right. Until, and I didn't, you know, go see Transformers 4 because I was like, I'm done with this. Like, I, right. You know, the first one was, you know, I guess the first one is, it's okay. It's watchable. It's decent. The second one is deplorable and is one of, like, the most racist mainstream movies I think I've ever seen.
Absolutely.
And I thought, you know, the third one, I thought the third one was going to be a huge improvement. I got sucked in. I believed the dream that, like, oh, well, you know, maybe it was the writer's strike. Maybe it was this. Maybe it was that. And I went and saw the third one. And I'm just like, this is still bad. I'm not falling for it anymore. Like, I'm not going to see any more Michael Bay Transformers movies. I'm just not going to do it. And I did go see the fourth one, and I felt great about it. And I had, like, 2 weeks of people in my, you know, Facebook feed complaining about how horrible it was. And I'm like, well, you shouldn't have went to see it. You knew it was horrible. I mean, he's at this point, if someone's giving you three movies and, like, two and a half of them were pretty bad, it's a pretty safe bet the fourth one is going to be bad too. I mean, just based on the evidence that you've been given. And, you know, I know that hope is, you know, hope gets you every time, but there are just some things that you can't expect. You can't expect a Michael Bay Transformers movie, you know, to be what anybody over kind of 12, you know, wants it to be. You know, like, if I was 12 years old, I would probably love these movies to death. And that kind of saddens me in a different way. But, you know, what can you do about it? I mean, just stop saying it. And, you
know, that's that. I mean, that's literally it. Don't go see them.
Right. You don't have to go see every single comic book movie, you know, that is released. You don't have to see it. It's just like, it's kind of like the thing you're talking about, you know, people complain about comics and stuff. You know, I have a rule, you know, if I read a comic and I don't like it, to me, that comic doesn't exist. It never happened. I have an entire room full of books, you know, that I love and enjoy, and I have them because I like them. I don't care what happened in some comic I didn't like, you know, or what was done with the character. If someone does something that I don't, you know, that I don't like or agree with about the character, like, you know, everybody knows that, you know, I love Tim Drake Robin. You know, I haven't been, super excited about a lot of the Tim Drake stuff that the New 52 has offered. So I don't buy it. I don't keep it in my house. It never happened. I mean, I have the entire run of, you know, Chuck Dixon's Robin, like, in the garage in a long box, you know, and I can go get it anytime I want to. And that's just basically how I work this stuff. Like, I'm not trying to keep complete uninterrupted collections of anything. Like, I don't, for probably like the last 10 years or so, like, I stopped being a comic collector and I started being a comic reader, where I read the stuff that I like, you know, I give it away, and then I buy trades and hardcovers of it. And if I didn't like it, you know, to me, it doesn't exist. It didn't happen, because it's not in my world, like, in this little world that I've created. That comic, that movie, that TV show, it doesn't exist. It doesn't have anywhere to exist in my space. And that's just kind of how I try to think about it mentally. I mean, everything is not going to be great. you know, everybody is not going to love every single thing. And that's just the, you know, that's just the cost of doing business. And I just want to spend a lot more time on the stuff that I enjoy and a lot less time on the things that I don't enjoy. Because, you know, just like you said, the world is awful. And I'm just not going to... people need to stop wasting so much time on trivial things that drive them crazy.
Exactly.
So, that's it. That's all I have to say about it. Batman can beat Superman in the comics.
Not gonna happen, bro. Not gonna happen.
Batman all day, clearly. But Man of Steel versus Dark Knight... you know, probably not all day. Bruce Wayne will probably be floating up in space in his stupid suit. So we'll see how it all happens, how it all develops.
Absolutely, bro.
So I think that's it. See, I told you this was going to happen. Like, we had this, you know, this giant list of things we could possibly get into. And I told Easton that once we got into the Batman-Superman thing, that was going to be it.
Forever.
And that was going to clear us out, you know, for the rest of the program.
Well, quick question. Are you going to Star Wars Celebration in Anaheim next year?
Oh, I should.
The tickets aren't, I mean, they're luckily, their tickets are still available, but it might sell out.
It's in what, February?
No, it's in, I believe, April or May, one of the two.
Oh, I need to go, because you know they're going to have, like, footage or an exclusive trailer or something.
I got my ticket last year.
I know. I remember you saying that you had gotten it, and I was like, oh, I should get one, too. So, maybe.
Because, you know, honestly, I have a bunch of Star Wars friends, and my whole life, well, not my whole life, since, like, the late 90s, I've wanted to go to a Star Wars celebration. Mm-hmm. And, you know, every year, they're someplace else. Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes they'll be in, like, Germany. Sometimes they'll be in Australia. Well, this time, they're in Southern California. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't know where they're going to be next year, but this is like the beginning of a Star Wars renaissance. And, you know, it's going to be interesting because, one, it's going to be nice to see what they're going to, what kind of exclusives are going to be on the floor.
Yeah,
and
I don't really, because it'll be so close to the actual movie.
Oh, God, yeah. And I don't buy Star Wars material other than books, other than comics and novels. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you never know what you could find there. It could be something really cool or... whatever, just to be at Star Wars Celebration the year that Star Wars returns, that's going to be awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, I might break, man. I'm trying to hold on to see, like, where the NFL draft is going to be next year, because if it's actually in L.A., I might try to do that, too. So, I don't know. I just have to, my mind's exploding right now, so I'm just going to have to, I have to pick my spot, but I've definitely given it a lot of thought, because I know that, you know, if I don't go, and they show, like, something that no one has ever seen, I'm just going to, like, go outside and just walk into traffic. Because I didn't see it. So we'll see. We'll see.
All right, brother. Well, it was great to do another episode.
Yeah,
thank God.
Yeah, great to,
been a while.
Great to get back in it. I didn't feel that rusty. So we'll call it a success. We'll call it home. So
awesome.
So thanks for joining us, guys. Hopefully we will not have we won't have such a long hiatus before the next one, but stay tuned on possible announcements about the secret project I've been doing for months, and also the future of the many adventures of Miranda Mercury. There are some things cooking in the background that I can't really reveal, but by the end of the year, I think that fans of the character in the book will be very, very happy about how and when and in what format she is going to return to the world. So that's it. Having said that, we will sign off for now. And this is Brandon Thomas.
And this is Brandon Easton.
And this is the two Brandons. We'll see you next time, guys. Thanks. Share it far and wide. Appreciate all the love on the Facebook page, and you know, appreciate your support. So, all right, we'll see y'all next time.
Take care.
All right.